Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, and today I'm going to be talking to a gentleman who, he comes from a Department of Biosystems and Agricultural Engineering at Michigan State. He's an expert on water, sustainability, modeling water, and it's an important area, as you'll find out, as you already know, in fact. His name is Dr. Puyan Nejat Hashemi, and welcome to Science Studio. Welcome to El Paso, Texas.
Thank you very much for having me.
And the program here, it's a conversation with a practicing scientist, engineer, and you fit into both categories. So what I'd like to find out, and the audience is always interested, where did the story begin? How did you start out, you know, when you were 5 or 15? And what are those stories when you were a young man, presumably growing up in Iran, in Persia? Tell us about that area.
Yeah, actually, you know, there are two aspects to how I am a person right now. One is a social aspect, and the other one is really the family aspect and, you know, enforcement, actually. The, you know, and on a social aspect, what was that? Almost everybody from Iran want to be engineer or doctor. Then, you know, this was always on our DNA.
Sounds like India.
Yeah. And this is what we want to do. And also my father is a university professor. Then, you know, this was my role model, and this is how I end up becoming this area. And he was actually become my professor at university too. Then, you know, I took a course with him, and he really, this was the motivation. But I really...
You actually had to suffer through taking a class from your father in the university.
Yeah.
Was that avoidable?
No, it's a required course. I have to take it. It's hydrogeology and it's a required course.
Did that put an extra strain on your relationship?
No, but, you know, I always had a problem because people know that my father is a professor too. Then I always need to really work even harder, you know, to show that I earned a degree or, you know, the grade for any specific class. It's become you're under the magnifier.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't think my children would have done that. They'd have found a way around that. But anyway, it's an interesting beginning to life. But before that, did you have an idea, apart from the concept of being an engineer or a doctor, was a scientist sort of still there somewhere or no?
You know, because of, again, the father influence, you know, his area is geology. He's hydrogeologist. Then I used to go, and during my high school, we have a one day a week that, you know, we take out of the high school and we go to the real work, and we see that one. Then I exposed to the graduate student, I exposed to the area of research. And, you know, this was one of my options. You know, I did like the medical school. Then, you know, that was out of the picture. But, you know, this was the one I was interested. And when I selected, you know, this was one of the top choices for me to pick in a school. And here I am.
Here you are. Okay. And brothers, sisters?
Yeah.
Did they all follow a similar... Any of them become a doctor in the end? A medical doctor?
No. My brother also a civil engineer, and but he only did undergraduate and started working.
So he got a real job?
He has a real job.
Tell us a little bit about the educational system. You're now on the faculty of Michigan State, but you spend a lot of the time in Tehran, and then you came to the U.S. for higher degrees, right?
Yeah. Then, you know, in terms of, you know, how tough it is and how strict it is, you know, there is nothing comparable, you know, that what I'm experiencing actually in Iran. Actually, when I came to U.S., everything was much easier for me.
Right.
And also the system was completely different. Then, you know, we used to memorize a lot. But, you know, I came to the graduate school, and this is also a different animal than, you know, undergraduate. But they bring a different perspective. I think that, you know, both of them are important. You know, there are sometimes that you need to be put under pressure, and this is generating your analytical thinking. I think this is the part that is in many areas, you know, we have struggling in the U.S. system. But that is make us very, you know, very good of thinking. But U.S. open us to many other areas. Department I came from is biosystem and agricultural engineering. And in the same department, we had four different concentrations. We have bioenergy, we have food, we have health, and we have ecosystem, all in the same department. Then, you know, the faculty in the same department, have to talk with each other, you know, generating ideas. And most of the idea come from, you know, you're listening to other. While, you know, when I was back home, when you are in water resources, almost 80% of the courses you're taking has something about water resources. Then you are not really exposed to other component, which actually I learn a lot. And, you know, right now I'm working with a professor in electrical engineering, geography, plant soil microbial sciences. All of the project is multidisciplinary, and this was a missing, at least when I left Iran. I don't know, you know, what the situation is right now.
And I mean, and that is so true, and we hear it a lot on Science Studio, this whole business of having a multitude of viewpoints of a particular problem. Our problems today are so big, right, that you just cannot be a X or a Y and tackle the problem. So water, though, is at the basis of your sort of general, and that's also following your father to a certain extent, you know. Talk to us about how you perceive the issue of water in today's world and in tomorrow's world, because I don't think it's getting better. So I'd like you to do a summary of where you think we are in a modern society with the issues of water.
You know, as you mentioned, it's become worse. It's not going to be better. The reason is that all of us know that majority of the Earth's surface is covered with the water, but only 2.5% of this is fresh water. But when you're really looking into, there are over almost 70% is in glaciers, 30% is, you know, in groundwater, and only 1.2% of this fresh water are available as surface water resources, which is readily available. And we have a limited resources. Then, you know, all the time, you know, we might go 5% up, down, but this is what we are dealing with in terms of fresh water resources. At the same time, we are experiencing something that we haven't experienced. We have increasing pressure on this one, including population growth. We're expecting by 2050, we have over 9 billion people living on the Earth. All of them need water. We also have the impact of the climate change that are going to affect the resources. And the climate change, it doesn't mean that you have more or less water. It means that you have maybe water at the time you don't need it, or you have excessive water at the time you have it. And this make it much more challenging. Then, you know, as you know, we discussed earlier, it's become multi-objective problem that you need to consider all of this aspect of that. The only way that we can probably make the life easier for us is become more smarter to how dealing with these things and do not actually treat these resources as unlimited resources, that it doesn't matter how much you tap in, you still have some.
The concept of having water when we don't need it, I'll never forget my brother-in-law. We'd go to Scotland quite a lot, and it was always raining, cats and dogs. And you'd see the water rushing down the hillsides, and he'd get so angry because, you know, a mere 200 miles to the south where he was, they were going through a drought. And he said, there's got to be a way for you engineers and scientists to divert all this water. Seems easy, but of course it's very difficult. You mentioned glaciers. Tell me where you see we are today, because you read a lot about the glaciers are beginning to disappear. Great National Glacier Park up in Montana. Yeah. I saw it 10 years ago, and apparently it's very different today in that short space of time.
Yeah, actually, it was interesting you brought up, because I had invited talk in China last fall. And the reason is because of the interboundary problem that they have with Lake Erie and the water situation that they have, they're seeing lots of changes. Then, you know, I spent 2 weeks visiting this area on both part of the world. And what we are experiencing is that in that area, which is the big hub of agriculture production, at least for China, they saw more water actually coming. And because the mountain and glacier are actually melting at a faster rate. But they're expecting that all of these glaciers are gone by 20 and 30 years. Then, you know, what's going to do after that? Then, you know, in the short period, this is not going to be a problem. But in a long period, which is actually, when I say long,
you're already talking 30 years.
Yeah, it's still in our lifetime. Then, you know, it's not something, you know, five generations after that thing. And, you know, earlier in our conversation, we had to discuss that when we see the impact of climate change and variability, this is the one that we did not experience 20 years or 30 years when we remember when we go into high school and all of this happened. Then, you know, what is happening is that we need to really open our eyes and looking at the problem as a system problem, not the individual. Then, you know, yes, we used to have maize here, or we have, you know, watermelon and so forth, but that might not be the scenario in the near future. Really, we need to start a strategy thinking about that one. The other part that was really missing and is big part of my research is that my lab called computational ecohydrology. Then I bring the ecosystem aspect of water need in addition of the human aspect, because for a very, very long time, we only looking at the use of water for human consumption. But that cannot be sustainable in long term if we're only looking at one objective. And there is an initiative. I don't call it a big initiative, but there is an initiative all over the country about dam removal. I was in Virginia, we had in Michigan, and I'm sure there is in other places around the country. They start removing dams because the ecological impact that dams generate are far beyond the benefit that they get for production of for agriculture. It doesn't mean that we don't need agriculture. We only need to be smarter to how to do agriculture and don't expand on agriculture in an area that we shouldn't and so forth.
I remember when I first came to Texas, I would drive up through what is called the Texas Panhandle. And I was always amazed when I'd cross the state line between New Mexico and the Texas Panhandle. New Mexico, it was no agriculture, but as soon as you crossed over, then there was lots and lots of cotton. But it was immediate, 100 meters across the border. When I've done that same trip 30 years later, you cross the border and it's dust. And then a few miles in, cotton. Simply because the cotton production was not sustainable. The water that was needed came from subterranean sources, becomes more expensive, becomes brackish, becomes unusable. So your point is these things happen in a very short space of time. And right here in the Rio Grande Valley, we have the biggest pecan nut production in North America, I think. It just struck me as curious and not sustainable eventually in the end. So what are we supposed to do?
Yeah, actually, you know, you brought the concept of sustainability. And I think that sustainability does not equaling to stop working. Actually, it's only become smarter how to work. Actually, I had a recent study done, which I have a presentation coming months, and we introduced a new concept called food footprint, which we're looking at different aspects of food production, including water, energy, you know, the amount that we're generating, carbon, and so forth. And what we find, for example, in Michigan, in milk production is the most sustainable way of doing the businesses. If we're reducing, is not sustainable way of doing that. Then, you know, I don't want that people are mistaking sustainability by shutting down the operation. It doesn't mean it only need to you shift it to the condition that make more sense. Then, you know, if I do not have water and I need to dig in 300-400 meters down, you know, to bring water, maybe I can use this energy in better way in some other region that have extra water and so forth.
That's right, and we'll come back to that. You're listening to The Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Nejat Hashemi from Michigan State, and we'll be back in one moment and continue this conversation.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Imagine facing surgery without anesthesia in a smelly operating room, and the surgeon enters wearing a blood-stained apron. I would run screaming out the door.
You and me both. Yet prior to the 1840s, that's how surgery was done. Surgeons did not wash their hands, instruments were not sterilized, and the patients were held down on the operating table.
Even though as early as 1546, Fra Castro of Verona postulated that small germs could cause diseases, no one linked them to wound infections.
A clue came later from Louis Pasteur, who showed that microorganisms could sour wine, beer, and milk, and expanded that into a theory that germs cause diseases. In 1862, he invented pasteurization, whereby bacteria could be killed by heating.
Later, a British surgeon, Joseph Lister, built on this knowledge to change surgery forever. He read Pasteur's work and theorized that the germs cause infections. At the time, so many people died after surgeries that there was a call to abolish the practice entirely.
Lister decided to begin treating all wounds on his wards with dressing soaked in carbolic acid because he had learned that this compound was used to disinfect sewage. He then began hand-washing sterilizing instruments and spraying carbolic acid in the operating room during surgery.
Other physicians criticized him even though Lister achieved remarkable success. But in time, his methods were adopted in Germany, the U.S., France, and then Great Britain.
He's hailed as the father of antiseptic surgery and saved a huge number of lives.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Professor Nejat Hashemi from Michigan State University, from a department which is called Biosystems and Agricultural Engineering. So, Puyan, you were talking about this whole concept of sustainability, and just because traditionally we've grown cattle in Texas, you know, and it's a big industry, but if there's not enough sustainability, not enough rain, drought conditions are prevalent right now, then we've got to think about shifting that agriculture somewhere else. And this is what we're talking about, yeah. Right? Where do you see anywhere in the world where that model is actually working successfully? Because the resistance to this is going to be phenomenal. If I was to suddenly suggest no more pecans in the Rio Grande Valley in New Mexico, you know, people would say, oh, Keith, shut up. Okay. Or if you were to say, okay, let's shift raising of cattle to Kansas and no longer in Texas. A lot of built-in resistance. So can you locate somewhere in the world where this change has begun to take place in what I might call an orderly fashion?
Actually, you know, one example I had is in New Zealand. Actually, one of my colleagues, Dr. Colleen Dibb at Electrical Engineering, defining a new landscape for forest production. And, you know, what is the most sustainable way is to do that? Then, you know, there are also the country who are on the front line of climate change start taking that more seriously. But they really think that it's not only about this subject, about any subject that human actually get involved. Education play a big role. What we need to understand that we are a global citizen. We are not only citizen of El Paso. Means that whatever action we consider are going to affect globally, and whatever the other people doing are going to affect us the same way. The other thing that we need to consider is that it's not only going to affect our generation, are going to have continuous impact on the future generation. Then if we care about our kids, grandkids, and so forth, we need to take this very seriously. But I don't say that this should come as a prescription. You know, I've worked when I was in Kansas, when I was in Michigan and Maryland, I work a lot with farmers. Then, you know, what I learned is that they are very intelligent people, but you need to have an intelligent argument too. Like, you know, why this is important for you and other people, or why the shift is makes sense. You know, the problem as a society that we are dealing is that we always go with one objective in mind. Can we make more money? But we don't know that can we continue make more money for how long? If it's continue for hundreds of years, I can see that one. But right now, the problem is that we get out of, you know, we don't have water in 10 years. Right now, two big cities in South Africa, you heard on news last week, ran out of the water. Then, you know, this should not get to the point that the system are going to be deserted. We should not get to the point of no return, and that's the problem.
I mean, I remember 30 years ago, I reading newspaper in Dallas, Fort Worth area, and they were talking about the water problem for El Paso, you know, and they had this dire sort of suggestion that within 25 years, El Paso would run out of water. And what that has stimulated here is a wonderful new tertiary water treatment. So the water I flush down the toilet today will come back, you know, later on in the week as good, clean water. And also we've got a big desalination plant here, the biggest one, I think, outside of any coastal area in the world, because we've got an underground balsam. It's very brackish. But again, we're sort of paying attention in a big way. And you're referring just now to this city, Cape Town in South Africa. It was in the newspapers recently, and I saw them having to bring bottles of water from a long way away. What's the current situation there, in fact?
They don't have the running water all, you know, day around, and they really don't have a solution. That's the situation I'm getting.
And is this a sudden feature, or were they just not paying attention and taking it seriously before?
They did not pay attention. Actually, I'm teaching an undergraduate and graduate class, and in my undergraduate class, I'm using a two-minute slide that was developed by United Nations. And in that two-minute slide, Cape Town name came out 10 years ago as a city that are in trade, including part of the Florida. El Paso was one of those names, actually, in this PowerPoint. And I'd be happy to share that PowerPoint, and you can have it on their website. Those stuff, you know, we were seeing those problems 10, 20 years ago. But we keep ignoring and we keep passing to the next administration, you know, to take care of that one. And these are the big problem, which requiring willing of many people to change the habit. And those important, if we are not going to the point of no return that, you know, right now Cape Town are visiting.
Is it really a point of no return? Are they beginning? I mean, maybe you don't know, and so we could move on. But yeah. I mean, population migration. I mean, people make these decisions for themselves.
Yeah, right? You know, I'm not expert on South Africa. You know,
no, okay.
You know politics or you know.
But it's a poster happening. Child.
Yeah, but
right
poster,
now.
No, the reason actually this came to my mind is because this was one of the city, El Paso, Miami, and Cape Town was the city that was in that slide 10 years ago.
Okay.
And identify that these are experiencing, they are going to experience water situation. Right now, you know, you are in Texas and, you know, you are not dealing with a drought. You are dealing with a mega drought, which is 20, 30 years long. It's not 3 or 4 years.
Right.
And, you know, those are all new problem that we're facing, which require new thinking. You know, not everything. I know that lots of people looking for a silver bullet, but there is no silver bullet in this complex problem. Then, you know, having a station down the road that, you know, desalinized water or, you know, finding another pill to drop in the dirty water and make it good, it does not make the societal problem. Yeah, it's good for you 2 days in desert and, you know, you can survive to get to the portable water. But, you know, long term with all of this agricultural, we cannot do that much desalination.
One of the things that I found out being in Texas is if you own property, you know, you can sell the property, but you don't necessarily sell the right to the water underneath it. And I'm even told, I was over in Midland, that goes down different depths. You know, the top 20 feet you can sell to somebody else and then lower down, you know, maintain your property rights. Around the world, because you must know this, because I've got no clue. If you own property, do you automatically around the world own the water rights underneath?
No.
Or is that just very much a North American phenomenon?
Again, you know, I'm not expert for everywhere, but, you know, two or three countries that are very
you
well
teach
known.
A freshman class,
yeah.
And a graduate class.
Yeah, but, you know, actually, I for sure know that this is not the case in Iran. Like, you know, government has the full power to move you. And they have everything is belong to the federal government, not to individual. Then, you know, if they find, you know, the oil in your house, this is federal government property.
Oh, really?
Not your property.
Oh, that's
then, you know,
not too many multi-millionaires because they're sitting on a bunch of oil.
Yeah, we don't have that scenario. But it doesn't mean that we are smarter, you know. the problem is that there is always a new election. I don't know. You know, there are new things coming that distract both public and, you know, the public servant from dealing with these big problems.
You mentioned earlier in the program, Huyan, that you do a lot of modeling. Tell the audience, what does that really mean? And what successes have you had Because modeling is fine, but it tends to always work backwards. You're trying to model what you know. I'd like to know some success of modeling something that you didn't know and has turned out to be important.
Yeah, you know, one of our fears about modeling is that we don't know what's happening. And, you know, this is a fear of many times I submit a paper and the reviewers say, how you know this happening? Did you go and dig something in the ground? But, you know, for any type of science things, we have a way of calibrating and validating our hypothesis. We do the same thing for modeling. Then what we have the observed condition, and we try to simulate very well those observed conditions. Then we have the period that we don't tell model what's going to happen, but we have an observed condition, and we tell the model to simulate those period. Right now, we are, especially in terms of hydrology, we have a very, very good fit based on what's happening in observed and what's happening in the future. And the same concept applied in the, you know, lab-based science. Like, you know, you calibrate the equipment for measuring a quantity of something and use the same thing, like making a scale. You calibrate the scale, and that scale is okay, even though you never had a 400-pound person on the scale before. It's going the same concept on that one. The other thing that actually model play a role, a big role, is, you know, for something that you observe at this moment, you might go and measure. But our problem, majority of problem, are not coming from what is happening right now, but what is happening in the future. They know how the decision in the future are going to impact it. And I always say you have two choices when we're dealing with this one. Either go and buy a crystal ball and look at the crystal ball, or really try to accept the result of the model. And model for our audience who never use word that is nothing out of the sky. You know, what we have, all of our knowledge about how different component works are actually integrated to each other, then the whole thing is working as a system. Then I know that when the water infiltrated, based on the type of the soil, how much can infiltrate per day, when it's going to evaporate it, you know, how the plant are going to be interacted. Then, you know, when you're looking at the big model, having thousands and thousands of equations that simultaneously is working.
I'm just listening to you and then thinking about what you've been talking about. And you mentioned earlier that you deal with farmers. And you pointed out that, and I agree from my limited knowledge of farmers, these people are very, very, very intelligent about their land. I mean, they think much more profoundly, especially family farms. They've inherited it. They want to give it on to their children. So, in fact, one assumes that you have to, in your modeling and in your discussion, involve people who actually are family farmers. As more and more farming becomes sort of corporate, you're losing that a little bit, I imagine. Do you notice, have you ever had to deal with farms which are sort of corporately owned as opposed to privately owned and they're more profligate?
Yeah, but the most farmers that I'm working are privately owned farmers. Mm. You know, I'm not working with the big farmers that, you know. But, you know, the situation actually, one of our innovation that we had when I was in Kansas State with one of your colleagues, Dr. William Hargrove, who are right now in El Paso, was a concept called adaptive management. We develop a concept called best management practice auction. Then what is this auction does is that we try to educate farmer from the start stage that what his model is, what the input is. We verify this with the farmers to get their trust and acceptability. Then, you know, we go through the process. You know, one thing that we identify early in the process, we find out why people are not going to buy conservation practices that offered by Natural Resource Conservation Service, you know, to control water quality and so forth. There are 10 questions, there are 10 reasons men identify, but there are two ones that identify the most is because federal government run these things, then we don't trust that one. The second one was, is very difficult. Then when you go to these offices, you need to fill out forms after forms after forms, and they need to come and visit you, and really does not worth your time to go through this thing. Then what we did through this adaptive modeling and BNP auction program, we make the model only one page, the system of communication only one page. It's going to be multi-point of conversation up to they see the final product. And at the back end, we use the most sophisticated model in order to track the pollution from individual farm to the river the river system. But on the front end, we are dealing with what we are applying and doing that one. And we went through, I got over $2 million grants from Great Lake Restoration Initiative to apply this in Michigan. We have more than 500 farmers was actually getting to this program, and they were very successful. We went through 10 rounds and so forth.
You know, we could talk 24 hours on water. I mean, what sense is there in growing oranges in Yuma, Arizona, where there's no water at all, and yet they find it because they dig it up? I mean, lakes around the world that are vanishing. We could carry on, and maybe we'll do another program. But right now, Puyan, we've got to say that's enough. We've run out of our 28 minutes or whatever it is. So I'd simply like to thank Puyan Nejat Hashemi from Michigan State University, from this beautiful department called Biosystems and Agricultural Engineering, expert on water, and thank you very much for being here on Science Studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I'd like to thank Lauren Terrazas for putting the program together, and you for listening. And we'll be back next week with another riveting Science Studio program. Bye-bye.